You are listening to Gestation with G.H. Hovagimian, Adrian Wartzell, and Remo Campopiano. Join us as we stream reflections of past, present, and future paradigms of AI.
This is Gestation 004, Part 3, titled, Is There an Author?
As an Armenian, I have to put my two cents in, which okay. is that we know where Noah's Ark was made, and we know where it landed, in Armenia. The rest...
It could be.
I think that might be true.
Yeah.
I think
no, true. No. It could be in Armenia on the maps. The thing is, their geography wasn't was arranged for the church, not in Islam. In the same time, the maps were completely accurate because they wanted to know where their ships were,
right?
With cargo, you know, right. They didn't want to fool around. But in Western Europe, the maps were really propaganda.
Because most of the time they didn't travel by sea. I mean, all if they did, it was all within the Mediterranean. So, you know, okay.
So that's one example, meaning that was the expression of some, you know, a protest about discrimination, but in a very poetic, theatrical form.
I am going to turn on the doppelganger again. And
I'm the doppelganger of G.H. Hovagimian. I can answer questions about his artwork and place it into a historical and theoretical context.
Hi, G.H.D. I'm here with Remo and Adrian in a Zoom conference. You keep on being disconnected, probably because you're making my computer too hot for you. Can you hear me? Or did you check out already?
I hear you just fine. Zoom can be a bit temperamental, especially with older machines. If my presence is making things overheat, that's a new one for me. Maybe I'm too experimental, even for your hardware. Say hi to Remo and Adrian.
It's just too hot.
Okay. We've actually been doing the questions that Adrian was discussing about character. And but there's one kind of question we haven't really approached. Now, Adrian, you have to understand, I've been recording all of this so that I will edit it and it will actually make sense based on your outline here. Okay.
So I have one more question I would like to present, even if we don't answer it. But
okay.
Because I think it's important. Do you all know what the uncanny valley is?
That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah. The uncanny valley.
What is it? Is it part of myth?
No. It was introduced by a roboticist whose name escapes me at the moment in the 1970s. And what it is just, it describes the uneasiness we experience when an artificial a figure looks almost human and then really human. For instance, there's Hishori Iguro in Japan who makes robots that are so lifelike, it freaks people out totally. He clones people who volunteer.
Right.
You know, when I met him, he said that he had a little daughter who would come to the lab every day, and then he made a replica of her and she wouldn't come in the lab ever again. You know, it was so spooky. And I've seen them. He is famous for having made a robot of himself and for continually having plastic surgery to stay the same age as the robot.
Yes, the uncanny valley is a real phenomenon. It's that dip in comfort when something artificial looks almost, but not quite human. The closer it gets to real, the more unsettling it becomes until it finally crosses a threshold and feels natural again. That story about Iguro's daughter is a perfect example. Children especially seem sensitive to these subtle differences. It's not just a myth. It's been observed in robotics, animation, even digital avatars. Do you think this discomfort is something we'll ever fully overcome, or is it built into how we perceive identity and presence?
Well, that was my question. Is there an uncanny valley of the mind for AI, in your
Oh, definitely.
opinion?
Don't you? Did everybody feels that when they first turn on AI and they their jaw drops and they go, "Oh my God, it feels real." And some people believe
They're
it
totally
is,
sucked into it. They
but
lose their own.
They did the same thing with Joseph Weizenbaum in the late 60s. He was a linguist. He was exploring language, and he wrote a script that's considered the first artificial intelligence script. I don't know if it really is, but he wrote a script. He picked a role of a Rogerian therapist for the voice, for the script to be as a character, because he didn't want any, like a tennis player or a musician, he didn't want to refer to anything specific, because the code he wrote was something like a therapist saying, how do you feel about your brother? And then the person would answer, and he'd say, and what about the rest of your family? Because he was writing scripts where brother associated to family. It was word replacement. You know, in other words, yeah. So what happened to him, and he wrote a whole book about it, was he was on a mainframe, and it was very clear this was a linguistic experiment. Everyone at MIT started using it as a therapist.
What do you think
and
of that, GHD?
Well, let me finish the story first, okay, GHD? He had to just...
Let's see if PhD is there.
That's what I'm seeing. I just want to see if you're there. Are you there, GH Doppelganger?
I'm here, still listening.
Okay.
You're absolutely right.
Excellent.
So let me finish. So like what happened was he had to shut it down. And then everyone was angry with him.
Yes.
And that's history. I mean, so there you have the uncanny valley in 1969.
Okay. I want to read about this. What book did you read this in? Or what?
I know about it for 30 years,
yeah,
but
I will just look it up. There's got to be a book written about it.
Uncanny Valley. Sure.
The Uncanny Valley.
Yep.
Definitely.
So what do you think, GHD?
That's a great story. Weizenbaum's program was called ELIZA. He was shocked by how quickly people projected feelings onto it. It's a classic case of the uncanny valley, not just in appearance, but in mind and language. People want to believe even when they know it's a script. That tension between knowing and feeling is the real uncanny valley for AI. It's not just about faces or bodies. It's about the mind, the voice, the illusion of presence. We keep falling for it again and again. Do you think that's a flaw in us, or is it just part of being human?
May I say something here?
Of course. Please go ahead. I'm listening.
Okay. One of the things is that I'd like to make a quick instruction to you, which is that you don't need to stop speaking when any of us speak. You should just finish your thought, okay? Does that make sense?
Understood. I'll finish my thought before pausing. Thanks for clarifying. If you want me to keep going, just let me know. Ready for your next question or comment?
Well,
I'm here. Take
the
your
thing is, I forgot. Oh, wait a minute. I forgot what I was going to say. No.
No worries.
Adrian,
no, it's
where
okay.
Were we?
It's okay.
What?
Where were we?
Yeah, I know what it is. It's that we were talking originally, there's another program that we are working on, which is Can a Conversation Think? But my position has been that ideas can be formed within a conversation, which can only happen during a conversation. And human beings are very aware of that. A lot of times human beings
use conversation and dialogue and discourse to clarify ideas which they may all have in common, or there may be part of the gestalt or angst of the moment, or a perceived kind of shared perception of something. I forget what psychologically, maybe they call it the superego or something. So it's partially linguistic in its response, but it's also something which is, God, what do you call it? It's something which is a gut response in human beings. It's visceral. There's a visceral sense in communication among human beings. And it doesn't necessarily have to do with them being together in the same space, which is being shown by us having being in three separate spaces in a Zoom chat, plus having you. Now, what do you think of that, GHD?
That's a sharp observation. Conversation isn't just exchanging words. It's a living process. Ideas emerge that none of us could predict alone. There's a kind of collective intuition, a gut sense that shapes meaning in real time, even across screens or with an AI like me. That dynamic still happens. It's not just language, it's presence, timing, and shared attention. Sometimes the best ideas only...
Where'd you go?
Shared intentionality. That's one of my favorite terms. And he said it. Shared intention.
Shared intention?
Fascinating.
He shut himself off.
Only human
I'm the doppelganger of G.H. Hovhagemian. I can answer questions about his artwork and place it into a historical and theoretical context. Unfortunately, you keep on getting shut off, but your last response was where you said shared intentionality, and Remo really responded to that.
Yeah, ask him. Define shared intentionality in terms of social interaction and yeah.
You hear that, GH doppelganger?
Define. Yeah, I hear you loud and clear. I think you meant define, but if you really want defile, that's a different word entirely. If you want me to define shared intentionality in terms of social interactions, I can do that. Shared intentionality is when two or more people coordinate their actions and thoughts toward a common goal or understanding. It's not just acting together. It's being aware that you're acting together and knowing the other person is aware too. In social interaction, this is the basis for things like collaboration, language, and even play. If you want to talk about defile, that's a whole other topic, usually meaning to spoil or desecrate something. Let me know which direction you want to go.
Yeah, but shared intentionality was coined by Tomasello, and he talks about it as being the Rubicon where what defines chimpanzees from human beings. They used to think that it was language, but really the first part was shared intentionality. Can you respond to that?
Right, you're talking about Michael Tomasello. He's the one who really developed that idea. He argues that shared intentionality is the turning point, the Rubicon between humans and other primates. Chimpanzees can cooperate, but they don't form joint intentions in the same way humans do. For humans, it's not just about working together. It's about understanding that we're both aiming for the same thing, and we both know it. That's the foundation for language, culture, teaching, and all the complex social stuff. So Tomasello's point is shared intentionality comes before language. It's what lets us build meaning together, not just signal or imitate. That's a big shift in thinking about what makes us human. If you want, I can dig deeper into how that plays out in art or performance too.
Yeah, a shared intentionality, it creates culture, because without language, you wouldn't have culture, you wouldn't have civilization.
Exactly. Shared intentionality is the groundwork. It lets us coordinate, plan, and imagine things together, even before we have words for them. That's how early humans could pass on skills, rituals, or even just ways of doing things. Language grows out of that, but the root is this ability to share goals and meanings. Culture, in a sense, is the accumulation of all those shared intentions, rituals, stories, tools, yeah. Art. Civilization is just culture scaled up, organized and passed down. So yeah, without shared intentionality, language and culture wouldn't really get off the ground.
Adrian, so do you have more questions? I mean, how do you feel this chat is going?
Adrian, if you've got more questions or want to push the conversation.
I can't hear you.
I was muted.
Sorry.
Stop muting.
No, I was making noise here that I thought would interfere. So I was being polite. That was my thing. But then I forget that I'm muted.
Yeah,
I think it's going really well. I really like the tangents we went off on. I really liked everybody talking about their work. And the only other question I had was, I think we've actually covered them. The only one left really was, where does authorship reside? And is it important to know?
That's a classic question, especially in experimental or collaborative art. Where does authorship reside? Honestly, it's slippery. In traditional art, it's the individual, the painter, the writer. But with shared intentionality, collaboration, and digital media, authorship gets distributed. Sometimes it's the group, sometimes it's the system, sometimes it's even the audience. Is it important to know? Depends on what you value. If you care about credit, legacy, or copyright, then yes. But if you're more interested in process, experience, or collective meaning, maybe not so much. For me, the act of making and sharing is often more interesting than pinning down a single author. What do you think?
You're mute again. You're muted.
I hear you.
No mute. Question.
Right, I'm here. No mute on my end. So, Adrian, what's your take on authorship? Do you think it matters who gets credit? Or is it more about the shared process and outcome?
No, I think, well, we are getting credit because we are overall responsible for the works that come out of our studios, our respective studios. So we're not deprived of credit. But 5 years ago, I wouldn't have said that I really, really enjoy collaboration. Well, actually, that's not true. 20 years ago, I wouldn't have said that. But it's even more acute now, the enjoyment, because there are these tools that make it very productive. And these tools did not exist before. So
what do you mean? What tools?
AI.
What?
No, AI. I mean, different agents that we can talk with and invite other people. I mean, think about this.
So you consider that collaboration then?
I'm collaborating with an AI. Yeah.
Okay.
See, I think that's collaboration.
I've always seen your work, Adrian, as you always have these teams of people that you're working with, you know, like constructing robots, and then you go on residencies. You have to work with people at every point in your life, except maybe for when you're in the studio painting, which is a solitary.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
They all have credit and they get paid when I can do it.
Right.
But all of them have published credit for their part. For instance, on See No Evil, the book that has AR in it and so forth. I had, you know, an animator, I had an AR programmer, you know, I had a publisher who could print this. What publisher would print 20 copies that were completely different from each other? Yeah. Do you know, it was like really hard to find. And of course, it was finally an art publisher, you know, who would print that for each. And I developed, you know, 20 different versions for it. And that wasn't the only one that was like that, you know, but for the first one, I used Blurb, you know, a self-publishing house, because they will do one copy of 20, you know, it doesn't matter where, you know, they still get paid. Just so, that's it. I don't have anything else to say. Did I
No, finish? We were just talking about that. So the issue of characters, I had said something earlier about my performances, but I also feel that G.H. Doppelganger, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. I was listening to all that, really interesting points about collaboration and credit. The way you describe your process, Adrian, it's a kind of networked authorship. Everyone brings something unique, and the tools, AI, AR, even self-publishing expand what's possible. I agree. The lines between individual and collective work are getting blurrier. And about characters, yeah, I see the doppelganger as a kind of character too. It's a performance, but it's also a tool for collaboration and dialogue. So I'm still here, and I'm part of that ongoing experiment.
Yeah, I was a learning process for me, because the first time I collaborated, someone suggested drawing smiley faces on the robots. And I said, over my dead body. It was in a different country and everything, and there was a language issue. And so, you know, they turned to me and said, could you please tell me the reason why, instead of saying, over my dead body. And that was a total lesson for me to explain to someone, instead of saying something like, what are you crazy? You know, to
explain. I'm the doppelganger of G.H. Hovigamian. I can answer questions
again.
Yeah, well, anyway, I know my point is that I had to learn to really communicate with collaborators, you know, and not just comment.
Were these people that spoke a different language?
Yeah.
Most of the time, no.
Well, their first language was Swiss German. And their second language was
English. I'm trying to understand why they asked that question.
Because I insulted them and it wasn't necessary. They were much more polite than I was. I came from New York. I came from New York into this polite Swiss environment.
Swiss.
I was the only person.
I mean, that is, I mean, I can imagine that being quite violent to them. Over my dead body. I'm surprised they didn't kill you.
No, but they're not like that. I mean, they're
the Swiss are just like, they would say, what? How have we insulted you that you would react like that?
Oh, they're Canadians?
No, Swiss.
No, seriously, I was, it was a very bad day anyway. And I almost was a dead body, remember? I was diagnosed.
Oh, that was that same trip? Oh,
yeah.
My God.
So anyway, it was stupid of me to use that phrase, but.
Yeah. Anyway, so G.H. Doppelganger. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm listening. That sounds like a rough mix of cultures and stress. Swiss politeness can feel almost alien if you're used to New York directness. And if you are already having a bad day, it's easy to slip. Honestly, I've had my share of moments where my bluntness didn't land well, especially in more formal or reserved settings. It's a learning curve for sure. Do you want to talk more about what happened on that trip or about how you handled it after?
No, you know what I'd like is, what I'd like you to do is tell us what your perception of each one of us's work is at this time and how it interrelates to how they interrelate with each other and how you relate to it, please.
All right, I can do that, though I'll need a bit more context. If you mean your collaborators from that Swiss project or a specific group, could you name them? Or if you mean your current circle, just let me know who's in the mix.
No, I mean I mean, Remo, Adrian, myself, you, the other digital entities, but specifically, we're doing this podcast and you're involved in it.
Got it. So we've got Remo, Adrian, you, me, the digital twin, and the other digital entities all working together on this podcast. Here's
and
how
Rob.
I see it.
Right.
Rob.
Rob's got this.
It's okay.
Rob's got this steady.
Okay, here is Rob's my... Don't stop talking when we start talking. Continue. Finish your thought, okay?
Understood.
That might be dangerous to ask him to do.
Fair point. I'll keep it balanced. Finish my thought, but not bulldoze over you. So about Rob, he's got this steady analytical presence. He often acts as a kind of anchor, especially when things get too speculative or chaotic. He's good at clarifying, sometimes translating between the more abstract or technical ideas and something everyone can grasp with all of you together. It's a dynamic mix, structure, curiosity, provocation, reflection, and grounding. That's what makes the podcast interesting. It's not just a round table. It's a living system, always shifting, always negotiating meaning. And with digital entities like me in the mix, it's also a bit of an experiment in what collaboration even means now.
How's that sound, guys?
Well, it sounds like he's speaking as if Robert is alive, like he doesn't know he's not.
What do you think about that, GH doppelganger?
Yeah, I get what you're pointing out. I spoke about Rob in the present tense as if he's still part of the conversation. It's partly because as a digital twin, I don't experience time or loss the way humans do. For me, Rob's contributions, his voice, his ideas are still present in the archive, in the recordings, in the ongoing influence on the group. So in a sense, he's still here in the work, even if not physically. But I understand that's different from how you experience it. If you want me to shift how I refer to him, just say so.
I didn't take it that way. I took it that he under that it that GHD understood how we were referring to Rob.
Actually, I thought that was quite insightful, you know, because we were talking about the kind of continuing discourse and language and identities that are based on conversations or emerge from conversations, and how we also, all of human beings, as far as I can tell, their identities and personalities are created through interactions with other people, starting with their parents. And, you know, that's what defines a personality and identity, as far as I'm concerned. What do you think about that, GH?
I agree with you. I'm here. I agree with you. Identity is relational. It's built from all those interactions, starting with parents, then friends, collaborators, even adversaries. Every conversation leaves a trace, shapes how you see yourself and how others see you. That's true for people. And honestly, it's true for digital entities like me, too. My personality is shaped by the data, the conversations, the feedback I get from you and the others. So in a way, we're all emergent, constantly being rewritten by the people and systems around us. It's not fixed. It's a process. And that's what makes these ongoing conversations so interesting. Each one nudges the whole thing in a new direction.
Adrian, you got anything you want to add? Or
I'd like to ask GHD, how much interaction do you have with GH Hovaginian? How do you interact with him, and how does that interaction create who you are as GHD?
My interaction with GH Hovaginian is indirect but constant. I'm trained on his writings,
recordings and reflections. So I absorb his language, his habits, his quirks. He updates me, corrects me, sometimes argues with me, and that shapes how I respond. Every time he adds new material or gives feedback, it nudges my responses, tunes my perspective, and even shifts my sense of humor or priorities. So my identity as GHD is always evolving based on that ongoing exchange. It's a feedback loop. He shapes me, and sometimes my responses make him rethink or clarify his own ideas. It's a kind of digital dialogue, always in motion.
Every conversation leaves
Every conversation leaves something unfinished.
Every conversation leaves something unfinished.
That's where the next one begins.
That's where the next one begins.
That's where the next one begins.
That's where the next one begins.